Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello. Thank you for joining us for the Sunday, April 14th, Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Mary Carley. We begin with the following articles. Space as a Hook by Eric Young. Barbara Morgan Talks Space Education by Savannah Eller. Colorado Wetlands by Marianne Goodland, Colorado Politics. And Checkered Threat to Property Rights by William Perry Pendley. Additional articles will follow. Space as a Hook. Educators using the subject to empower students. As a longtime educator, Jamie Seabolt knows it's not always easy to get her students excited about math, science, and reading. Giving them any reason to talk about space, on the other hand, is much easier. A fifth grade teacher at Skyway Elementary School, Seabolt has implemented space-related education and resources into her classes to engage students and generate curiosity. Kids don't really respond to worksheets, she said. If you don't get them excited about reading and math, you can lose them. She's also a longtime member of the Space Foundation's International Teacher Liaison Program, a community of 400 educators across 40 states and 25 countries, working to enhance K-12 education and inspire students to explore career paths through a space lens. During the 2024 Space Symposium, Seabolt and a group of educators met at Cross and Crown Church near the Foundation's headquarters to share and discuss different approaches to space-themed education to further engage students in science, technology, engineering, and math. Over the past year, the Foundation partnered with the Space Workforce 2030, that's SW 2030 Initiative, whose goal is to inspire students at a young age and prepare them for employment in the space industry. The push for space education comes as the industry scrambles to fill a shortage of qualified workers. On Tuesday, SW 2030 released its second annual space report, intended to track the progress of its goals while expanding diversity in its workforce. According to the report, the number of private sector space workers in the United States increased 4.8% in 2023, while employment in the U.S. space sector grew to 222,300 positions. That's up from 201,000 in 2022. Industry leaders believe the workforce shortage isn't due to a lack of inspired or qualified applicants, but rather a lack of awareness of the industry as a whole and the number of opportunities available. Jenny Anderson, the Foundation's Education Program Director, said the workforce shortage is largely due to the perception that space industry jobs only apply to those with the highest qualifications. In addition to aerodynamics and cybersecurity, jobs and careers available throughout the space industry include engineering, communications, marketing, and machinist positions. Kids can often get intimidated or think they're not smart enough for a career in space, but a lot of them don't realize all the options they have, she said. Part of the liaison program's mission is to provide teachers with resources. Lessons for fourth and fifth grade students teach them about science, math, and art through planetary system and constellation activities. Kindergartners participate in story time from space with an astronaut via live stream. In addition to its liaison program, SW2030 has worked with businesses in the space industry to provide students with hands-on projects, demonstrations, and presentations. Anderson said these options familiarize students with various jobs and careers the space industry offers, along with providing connections to the people within it. "We use space as a hook," she said. 34 companies have signed the foundation's pledge since it was first announced in 2022 to meet these educational needs and increase diversity throughout the industry. According to the annual report, women and people of color employed in technical staffing positions rose from 18.5 to 19.4% and 32.7 to 34.1% respectively. SW2030 Executive Director Melanie Strickland said the group has increased diversity through its National Space Interns Program, which pairs diversity candidates with SW2030's partner companies. Registrations have increased from 300 to 4,500 over the past year. After last year's report, internships for women held relatively steady from 30.5%, while people of color rose from 46.77% to 48%. Intern to employment conversions for women dropped from 34.7% to 30.2%, while they rose for people of color from 42.7% to 46.4%. "We've made serious progress, as you can see, across these areas," Strickland said. "A couple of areas did go down, and that just allows us to really dive in and understand why it drives our next focal point to drive those numbers up. Efforts to increase diversity and inclusivity also include reaching students from various economic backgrounds and different types of learners." This year's report noted that K-12 STEM student outreach in 2023 reached 7.8 million students. That exceeded its goal of 5 million. Of those students, 58,000 came from Title I schools. At the college level, local universities have worked to increase the number of degree programs and career pathways that can be applied to the field. In 2022, UCCS began offering a Bachelor of Science degree in aerospace engineering that gives students the option to pursue either a career focused on aeronautical engineering within or outside the atmosphere. Going forward, SW2030 plans to expand its partnerships to include government affiliates, nonprofit organizations, as well as recruitment efforts to historically Black colleges and universities and Indigenous communities. Plans are also in the works to expand the National Space Interns Program to a broader range of applicants, along with intern-to-employment opportunities over the next year. For younger students, SW2030 will hold a National Space Day on May 3rd, when it will broadcast a 45-minute video to 4th and 5th grade classrooms nationwide that will allow students to learn from and interact with the space industry and NASA. Thousands of classes have already signed up to participate. SW2030 is still in its early stages, going into its second year. But Strickland believes the growth in numbers and partnerships has been very encouraging. "This is a journey. This is not a destination," she said. "And we all have to come together to resolve the workforce gap." Educator and former NASA astronaut Barbara Maugin talks space education. Former NASA astronaut and teacher in space Barbara Maugin told educators at the Space Symposium last week that increasing the time, resources, and creativity given to science education is key to building the next generation of astronauts. If we did not have high-quality teachers and students in great classrooms getting high-quality education, none of this would be possible, she said. Morgan taught in multiple school settings before being selected for the Teacher in Space program as the backup for Christy McAuliffe and the ill-fated Challenger mission. Afterward, she was selected for NASA's General Astronaut Program. Joining a Space Shuttle Endeavour mission to construct the International Space Station. She retired in 2008. On Wednesday, Morgan met with 50 teachers involved in the Space Foundation's Teacher Liaison Program, which gives teachers nationwide resources to use in the classroom to teach space subjects. She said she wanted passionate educators to be given the opportunity to get a little stardust on them. One such educator was District 20 Pioneer Elementary School special education teacher Bella Power, who said she developed some new classroom rocket experiments to try out of the Space Foundation's programming at the Space Symposium. Power, who said she loved watching space movies like Contact growing up, said that bringing space into her classroom was an obvious choice. Students love space, she said. It's all about finding something they're interested in and engaged in. Then you have their attention, and you can bring math, writing, and reading in to supplement what you're doing. They get so excited about it. They don't even care that they're working on academics. With trailing state test scores after the educational disruptions of the COVID-19 pandemic, elementary school educators are under pressure to help students meet benchmark on core skills, including math and literacy. Power said that as a special education teacher, she tries to integrate science concepts while also focusing on reading, writing, math, and remedial skills. I think it's harder now than ever. Our teachers are being asked to do everything, and that's tough, Morgan said. She said science education should be considered among the core skills taught in elementary school alongside math and literacy. It brings in all the skills that young people, as they go through life, need, whether it's creative problem solving, critical thinking, communication, or teamwork. All of those things, she said. Power wants her students to feel they're part of space, including the upcoming NASA mission to land people on the moon for the first time since 1972. I tell my students, you are the Artemis generation. Colorado's wetlands. Lawmakers clash as they ponder state protections. How Colorado protects wetlands depends on two perspectives. Is it a water quality issue or a land management issue? Even assuming it's a little of both, either answer leads to different approaches, each to be overseen by a different agency. And either path offers implications for construction, permitting, and management of habitats. This month, lawmakers looked at the dueling approaches contained in two measures seeking to implement a way for the state to manage dredge and fill discharge permits tied to a recent U.S. Supreme Court decision that redefines how a body of water can be protected under the Environmental Protection Agency's Waters of the United States rule. Supporters of the first bill, which gives the task to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment insist it's the proper venue because it has experience dealing with permitting and water quality issues. Supporters of the second measure, which hands the responsibility to the Colorado Department of Natural Resources, maintain that the Department of Natural Resources is better equipped because it deals with related disciplines, including water resource management, water rights law, and land management. In any case, policymakers agree that Colorado residents, industries, and the wetlands need certainty. Will Colorado wetlands lose protection? The proposed changes in Colorado arose out of the U.S. Supreme Court's 9-0 vote in May in favor of the Sacketts. They're an Idaho couple who bought land on which they wanted to build a home in 2004. The parcel was 300 feet from Priest Lake, one of the state's largest. They began backfilling the lot with dirt and gravel, which earned them the attention of the EPA. The agency said the land contained a protected wetland across a paved road and was connected by a ditch and creek to Priest Lake. The EPA blocked the development, partly because the Sacketts did not obtain a permit for dredging and filling discharge from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which manages wetlands. The majority opinion, written by Justice Samuel Alito, relied on a 2006 opinion in Rapinos versus United States from Justice Antonin Scalia. That viewpoint held that any wetland that does not connect at its surface to another body of federally protected water does not merit the same degree of protection. Alito noted, the wetlands on the Sacketts property are distinguishable from any possibly covered waters. The ruling's potential impact in Colorado, according to some experts, is to lose protection for nearly 1 million acres of wetlands. Alex Funk with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership told a legislative committee in August that 90% of fish and wildlife in Colorado rely on the state's wetlands at some point during their life cycle. House Speaker Julie McCluskey told the House Agriculture Committee on April 8th that since Sackett versus Environmental Protection Agency held that only permanent streams and rivers are protected under the Federal Clean Water Act, those with a continuous surface connection to another permanent water body. That puts Colorado waters at risk, she said. Pitkin County Commissioner Greg Poschman also noted that the state's headwaters are made up of small streams that do not have year-round flow because they're under snowpack for half the year, suggesting Sackett would put those waters at risk. Many of these areas are seasonal wetlands and wet meadows, Poschman said. These pristine headwater streams flow into the western rivers, which are the very backbone of our state's recreation, tourism, and agriculture economies. They recharge groundwater, filter pollutants, ensure clean drinking water, and reduce the risk of flood, drought, and wildfire. Another expert estimates that 45% of Colorado's streams are intermittent and 24% are short-term in their lifespan. That leaves two-thirds of Colorado waters outside waters of the United States protections. Debbie Ford, who lives in the foothills of Jefferson County near Turkey Creek and Shadow Mountain, where there are 11 designated wetlands, said Sackett took away their protections. Without essential protections of our water and wetlands, we jeopardize our wildlife, she said, adding wetlands provide most wildlife habitat. The Colorado approach. While the issue has been a concern since the Trump administration narrowed the EPA rule in 2020, after the U.S. Supreme Court decision came out, Governor Jared Polis convened a task force to figure out how Colorado should respond. The task force considered two thoughts. One was a GAP program that could cover any waters no longer protected by Sackett. The other was what supporters called a Colorado-based approach that relied on existing state law about what defined Colorado waters, and which would be much simpler to operate. In any case, Colorado is now in the position of developing its own permitting program to protect those wetlands, particularly for dredge and fill discharge permits. That led to hearings during the week of April 8th, with the two competing measures coming up in House Bill 1379 and Senate Bill 127. Already reviewed by the House Agriculture Panel, House Bill 1379 is sponsored by McCluskey. Agriculture Committee Chair Representative Karen McCormick of Longmont and Senator Dylan Roberts of Summit County, who chairs the Senate Agriculture and Natural Resources Committee. The other measure, Senate Bill 127, is sponsored by Senator Barbara Kirkmeyer, a Republican from Weld County, and Representative Shannon Byrd, a Democrat from Westminster. Tasking Health and Environment. House Bill 1379 would set up a regulatory structure for dredge and fill discharge permits to be managed by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. It would cost $545,000 and require an additional 4.1 full-time equivalent employees in its first year. Under the bill, the Health and Environment Agency would establish rules for regulating discharge dredge and filling materials into state waters, including wetlands. Anyone discharging dredge and fill materials into a state water that doesn't have an exemption, and the list of exemptions is lengthy, would need a permit. Funk of the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership explained that one major effect of the Sackett decision applies to the 404 permitting system under the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Those permits are used for dredging a river for navigation purposes or filling in wetlands for construction, as was the case with the Sacketts. Colorado law only allows dredge and fill discharge activities with a current federal permit. McCluskey surmised the court decision could make those permits illegal because they're in waters no longer regulated by federal agencies. Without a state permitting program, those engaged in dredge and fill discharges could be left to guess whether they should move forward with those projects or risk drawing enforcement actions. The state does not want enforcement to be the only solution to the issue, McCluskey said. The state approach under House Bill 1379 would be based on established permitting paths developed by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, such as the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment's longstanding permitting program for stormwater and wastewater discharges. McCormick told the Ag Committee that construction partners, agriculture producers, and the conservation community needs certainty. And House Bill 1379 will deliver that certainty. The Public Health Department manages over 12,000 water permits under the 402 process, which applies to stormwater and wastewater discharge. Half of those 12,000 permits are for construction. McCormick said supporters prefer the state's Health and Environment because of its experience in the permitting space. But the agency also has a backlog in permit approval that's been a sore subject for years. Its system shows a backlog of 2,400 cases, delayed or administratively continued permits. That backlog goes back to 2010, and several permits expired in 2012 and are still waiting approval. In October, the Public Health Department said it would need more full-time employees to pare down the backlog to get up to 75% of permits approved. The fiscal analysis for House Bill 1379 estimates that approximately 110 projects per year would need new permits. The Department of Natural Resources plan. Senate Bill 127, meanwhile, would establish a Stream and Wetlands Protection Division and a commission within the Department of Natural Resources, which would create the rules for a dredge and fill discharge program. Until then, the bill would prohibit the Health and Environment Agency from taking enforcement actions outside projects. If those projects are conducted in a manner that protects state water under the Waters of the United States rules that existed prior to Sackett, the measure also includes enforcement provisions. But critics of Senate Bill 127 note the Natural Resources Department has little experience in permitting. Its primary permit program is on well water. Doesn't deal with federal issues, hence it would have to start a 404 type of program from scratch. That's a big part of why the Senate bill has such a high cost compared to the House bill. That's $545,000 and 4.1 full-time equivalent employees for House Bill 1379, compared with $3.8 million and 23.5 full-time equivalent employees for Senate Bill 127. The full-time employee requirements in the latter bill include administrative and permitting staffers. The fiscal analysis for Senate Bill 127 also takes a different view of what would be required to handle the wetland permits. The analysis said the bill's staffing amounts anticipate that the new division would assume 70% of the Army Corps' previous actions. That equates to 18,600 hours of determination, permitting, inspection, enforcement, consultation, and supervision work per year, the analysis concluded. Bill sponsors, Senator Barbara Kirkmeyer, Republican from Weld County, said that while the Public Health Department approves 402 permits on water quality, what the state faces after Sackett is not a water quality issue. We believe in a permitting process, and we need one very similar to 404, but with the definition from Sackett. The task should go to the Department of Natural Resources because that is the agency that handles floodplain administration and the state water plan, the Colorado Water Conservation Board, the state engineer, well water permits, and the Division of Mining. The agency also has experience in agriculture and water rights that the Public Health Department lacks. All those divisions work with entities that would seek new permits. However, the Department of Natural Resources is in full support of House Bill 1379. Kelly Romero Heaney, Deputy Policy Director at the Department of Natural Resources, said her agency has full confidence in the Public Health Department's ability to develop and implement a dredge and fill discharge permitting program. Water quality? To supporters, House Bill 1379 offers a direct approach to protecting Colorado's wetlands. Poshman, the Pitkin County Commissioner, said House Bill 1379 would cover all state waters not covered by the federal permit program from the Army Corps of Engineers. This direct approach ensures protection of perennial, intermittent, and ephemeral streams and vital wetlands. While our riparian and river areas may comprise a tiny percentage of Colorado's landscapes, they are essential to our very survival and to virtually all wildlife survival. Poshman also said those who depend on clean water from Colorado's headwaters, including its wetlands, include the 40 million people who rely on the Colorado River. Some of the strongest support for House Bill 1379 came from a former EPA official. Gene Reitz, who retired from the EPA Region 8 as a senior water resource scientist and who supervised the region's Wetlands Protection Program, said there were numerous changes in federal policies to protect wetlands and other waters throughout his time at EPA Region 8, which includes Colorado. I think there's considerable merit in Colorado developing its own program so that the state has consistency and predictability in protecting water resources. Reitz said that while there haven't yet been studies on the effects Sackett will have in Colorado, a study in New Mexico showed 88% of that state wetlands would be at risk, as well as 95% of its rivers. Numbers, he said, would likely be close to Colorado's. There is incredible scientific documentation about the connectivity of our waters, be it wetlands, intermittent streams, or perennial streams, Reitz said. It's critical that Colorado's program develop all of these waters. Or land management. Jim Sanderson, a water attorney and Colorado Water Congress member representing agricultural and mining interests, also advocated for Senate Bill 127 and the program to be put under the Department of Natural Resources. Senate Bill 127 contemplates a separate commission to manage the program, which is favored by the group. A division that only works on these issues has a better chance of success, rather than adding it to an existing agency. Adam Ekman from the Colorado Mining Association explained the logic of putting the program under the management of the Department of Natural Resources. Ekman said that department remains the most appropriate for the task, given its experience with related disciplines such as water resource management, water conservation, land management, fish and wildlife management, and mining and reclamation operations. Water Attorney Sanderson said House Bill 1379, in contrast to Senate Bill 127, creates a multi-step process that's unnecessarily complicated. Meanwhile, the Colorado Water Congress, which is the state's largest water advocacy organization, took a firm position opposing the bill, even with amendments. The group supports Senate Bill 127 instead. As written, House Bill 1379 could injure water rights, said Gabe Rax, a water attorney and Water Congress board member, claiming it would also create confusion among the regulated community and disrupt the relationship with federal programs. To Kirkmeyer, the health department should pursue its water quality mission, but 15 years behind is not acceptable for discharge permits. I don't know how they can look at anyone with a straight face and say they should have additional permitting. Checkered threat to property rights. It's Congress's responsibility to resolve Wyoming's crossing controversy. In C.J. Box's latest novel, 3-Inch Teeth, about a rampaging grizzly bear, Box's hero, Wyoming game warden Joe Pickett, encounters three Pennsylvania hunters on Bureau of Land Management lands in southern Wyoming amid checkerboard federal and private lands. Pickett tells them, while they may legally hunt on federal lands, they cannot hunt on private lands without the rancher's permission. In fact, corner crossing from one BLM parcel to another invades his airspace and constitutes trespassing. The hunters display a ladder built to cross onto BLM land without setting foot on private land. In fact, they use GPS apps to ensure they do not. Pickett says he can't stop them, but warns the county sheriff will arrest them, especially if he hears from the landowner. Reflecting, Pickett sees both sides. Licensed hunters may access public lands, but landowners may exclude strangers. Still, he ponders, if people can wander across ranchers' lands whenever they please, is private property actually private? Wyoming native Box and Pickett know whom to blame for why corner-locked public lands is a big issue in the West. The federal government reports Pickett in Wyoming alone, there are 2.4 million acres of those lands. That's a landmass larger than the state of Connecticut. Pickett's big Western issue is getting huge and going national, thanks to litigation decided in May by a Wyoming federal district court and now before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit in Denver. Because the controlling legal precedent was decided by the Supreme Court decades ago, it's headed there. The case began over a century and a half ago in 1862 when Congress authorized a railroad from the Missouri River to the Pacific Ocean. Recognizing the cost due to the distance, dangers, and difficulty, land uncrossed except for wagon trains, Congress granted railroads every other section of land within 20 miles of each side of the track for use or resale. The rest remained federal. Because under the Constitution, Congress has exclusive authority over the territory or other property belonging to the United States, and because the founders sought disposal of all federal lands, Congress enacted laws to accomplish that goal, beginning with the Homestead Act of 1862. Meanwhile, Congress authorized economic uses of federal lands, including mining, livestock grazing, and timber harvesting. It was not until 1960, as to national forests, and 1976 on BLM lands, that Congress listed recreation as one of the multiple uses permitted there, with none favored over another. Also, 1976 marked the end of the disposal era. Henceforth, it is the policy of the United States that the public lands be retained in federal ownership unless disposal of a particular parcel will serve the national interest. East of Wyoming, most federal lands were homesteaded and transferred into private hands. 1.1% of Nebraska is federally owned. But through Wyoming, Utah, and Nevada, most lands remain federal. Nearly half of Wyoming, 63% of Utah, and 80% of Nevada are federally owned. In conveying the federal land to railroads, Congress could have expressly reserved easements to effectuate federal purposes, including ensuring public access to other federal lands. That the federal government's implicit authority is limited, however, the government discovered to its detriment before the Supreme Court in 1979. In Leo Sheep Company versus the United States, a Carbon County, Wyoming case involving checkerboard lands created by Union Pacific Railroad grants and conveyance of some lands to private landowners, federal authorities claimed the right to clear a dirt road across a rancher's land over his objections and without just compensation for public access to a reservoir for fishing and hunting. No, ruled a unanimous court. Justice William Rehnquist, with Justin Byron White taking no part in the case, wrote that the Union Pacific Act reserved no property rights to the federal government and rejected the government's argument that settled rules of property law, including easements by necessity, supported its right to build the road. Easements of necessity, the common law presumption that a conveying landowner retaining the right to use transferred land to access his inaccessible land, did not apply, held Rehnquist, because that right did not include construction of a road for public access. More importantly, those easements were denied the federal government due to its eminent domain powers. That is, authority to condemn property and pay just compensation. Plus, noted Rehnquist, Wyoming does not recognize easement by necessity, even as to private parties. As to the Unlawful Enclosures of Public Lands Act of 1885, enacted in reaction to the range wars between stockmen and farmers, which barred fencing or enclosing lands to deny free passage or transit over or through the public lands, Rehnquist held it did not apply. Certainly, it did not apply to a landowner's opposition to a public road across his property. Moreover, the court held in 1897 that notwithstanding the act, landowners could fence their land, so long as the individual proprietor confines his enclosure to his own land. The government has no right to complain, since he is entitled to the complete and exclusive enjoyment of it, regardless of any detriment to his neighbor or the public. With this background, the Wyoming Federal District Court, after removal from a Wyoming state court, heard a civil trespass case brought by a Wyoming landowner against four Missouri hunters who admittedly crossed multiple corners between BLM parcels and in the process trespassed through adjacent private airspace. Remarkably, the district court relied not on the Leo Sheep ruling, but on the 1914 Wyoming case held by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, which never reached the Supreme Court. That court sustained the right of a rancher to graze his sheep upon the land of a neighbor as he drove them to public land. Thus, long before Leo Sheep, the appeals court held a member of the public land the right to trespass upon a neighbor's land because the federal government provided him no other access to its land where he had the right to graze his sheep. The Wyoming District Court did not discuss how a person could, on his own behalf, assert and obtain a right not granted him by the federal government, when the federal government, on behalf of the public at large, could not assert a similar access right. Instead, acknowledging the Wyoming landowner's inability to exclude the public from its land was not a problem of its making, nor was the public's inability to access public lands a problem of their making, the Wyoming District Court concluded both should share in the solution. The private landowner must suffer the temporary incursion into a minimal portion of its airspace, while the corner crosser must take pains to avoid touching private land or otherwise disturbing private property. This might sound Solomon-like, but it's not. It's neither legal nor constitutional, nor in conformity with applicable precedent, specifically Leo Sheep. Notwithstanding the Wyoming District Court's holding that the public is entitled its reasonable way of passage across private property to access public land, there is no statutory or legal authority for that holding. All authority is to the contrary. Congress never reserved an easement for access across these lands, nor was there an implied easement ensuring public access, as Leo Sheep and subsequent Supreme Court rulings made clear. That's especially so regarding recreation, which Congress did not recognize on its BLM lands until 1976. Besides that year, Congress, aware that public access to vast public lands throughout the West was a nettlesome issue, granted the Secretary of the Interior Department the power of eminent domain to secure access to public lands limited to as narrow a corridor as necessary to serve such purpose. Today, with funds from Great America Outdoors Act, signed into law by former President Donald Trump, the BLM acquires private lands to provide public access to heretofore inaccessible federal lands. Meanwhile, over the decades, the Wyoming Bureau of Land Management informed hunters that corner crossing is illegal. Nonetheless, Wyoming's federal district court fashioned a remedy and balanced equities regarding an issue to which Congress is aware, but to which Congress, which alone has the constitutional authority, has not acted. Consequently, for hundreds of agricultural producers who own thousands of acres of private land in Wyoming, the result is Joe Pickett's worst fear. Their land is no longer private. Simply put, as we say at the Supreme Court, the Wyoming District Court's ruling that members of the public are entitled to a reasonable way of passage across private land to federal land lacks a limiting principle. Given the breadth of the word recreation, who besides hunters may now trespass on their private land among their livestock? Worse yet, the all-encompassing, ever-expanding, and uncompensated burden for this heretofore unknown right is imposed destructively solely on stockmen. If not reversed, the Wyoming's federal district's court ruling will result in an unprecedented and massive taking of private property for public use without just compensation. That's contrary not only to the will of the 37th Congress, but also antagonistic to the U.S. Constitution and the vision of the founders themselves. It was these men, after all, who recognized property rights as the foundation of America and wealth creation, and as the sole guarantor of individual rights, personal independence, and liberty. If the inability of a few scores of hunters to access isolated BLM lands in the vastness of Wyoming is a problem, then Congress can fix it. Meanwhile, let Wyoming enforce its trespass law and leave its ranching families alone. State Legislature Debating Single-Family Zoning by Bob Levy. People on the Front Range who live in homes with single-family zoning should pay close attention to two bills under consideration in the Colorado State Legislature at the state capitol in Denver. One of those bills would, in effect, turn single-family zones on the Front Range into two-family zones. The other bill would encourage higher-density development along major bus routes. House Bill 24-1152 would allow auxiliary dwelling units, known as ADUs, in single-family zones on the Front Range. That's Pueblo through Colorado Springs and Denver to Greeley and Fort Collins. The law will not apply in ski resort areas such as Aspen and Vail, which will be allowed to keep single-family zoning. An auxiliary dwelling unit can be added inside an existing single-family house or built in the backyard as a separate freestanding home. In either case, the ADU can be either rented or sold to a second family, which can move in and live on the property next to the original owner. The property, originally single family, is now hosting two separate families rather than just one. There is another way to go when ADUs are permitted in a single family neighborhood. Investors will buy the property, tear down the single family home, and build a larger and more modern two family house or duplex in its place. When this occurs, the original single-family home will have been said to have been scraped off. Note that when a single-family home is replaced on the same lot by a two-family home, the population density has doubled. At the same time, the number of autos driven in the neighborhood by the two families will double as well. Supporters of ADUs in single-family neighborhoods believe more housing is needed at all price levels. In addition, some of the new homes constructed will qualify as affordable housing. Others support densification in existing single-family neighborhoods because it results in more efficient use of resources. New homes are added to the city without using raw land in expanding suburbs at the rim of the city. Also, utilities such as water, wastewater, natural gas, and electric power are close by and efficiently attached to the additional homes without making long, expensive extension of utility lines. Often, where ADUs are permitted, an older, historic-looking single-family house will be torn down and replaced with a modern two-family structure. This has made ADUs very unpopular with historic preservation organizations in older cities. In Colorado Springs, for instance, House Bill 241152 is strongly opposed by people who live in older historic neighborhoods surrounding the downtown area. They seek to preserve the historic look, character, and quality of life in their neighborhood. Their main argument is that new housing and affordable housing should be built in the community, but not at the expense of already existing neighborhoods. In short, if you want to preserve your home's single-family zoning and do not want it to become two-family zoning, then you should strongly oppose House Bill 241152. Another legislative bill of interest to homeowners is House Bill 241313. It applies to any property in a Front Range city which is within a quarter of a mile of a bus route where a bus runs every 15 minutes. House Bill 241313 creates a detailed process by which cities will evaluate population densities along major bus routes. If the process reveals that the population densities are not high enough, remediation in the form of zoning changes will be required. The logic here is to increase the population along the bus route so there will be more potential riders for the buses. A highly debated part of this law is that in those cities that do not make the zoning change required by December 31st, 2026, the city's share of the state highway users tax fund will be withheld by the state treasurer. Thus, cities will face a major financial penalty for not meeting the state legislators' required population density levels on major bus routes. There are many major bus routes in the cities on Colorado's Front Range. Many of these routes are lined with high-density uses such as high-rise apartment buildings and commercial establishments. There are many other bus routes, however, lined with single-family homes for many blocks that would be vastly changed by this legislation. In many cases, the older single-family homes lining the bus routes are of historic significance. Thus, if you live in a single-family home on a major bus route in a city on the Front Range and do not want to see your house and neighborhood radically changed, you should probably oppose House Bill 241313. Political scientists have a word for bills such as these. They are called ripper bills, because they rip control over city government issues such as ADUs and population densities along city bus routes and lodge those powers at the state level controlled by the state legislature. In closing, thank you for joining us for the Sunday Colorado Springs, read by Mary Carley.
AfterSight presents your low vision resource of the day, the
IRA
app. This app provides visual interpretation by trained agents for just about any task. The app is free to download and has in-app purchase options. Download it in the App Store or learn more by visiting www.aira.io or calling 1-800-835-1934 or emailing support@aira.io.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777. You're listening to AfterSight.